Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Hello?
John?
Hello?
John Huckenberry.
Who is it?
It's your 3 a.m. wake-up call.
Who is it?
Is that Bob Edwards?
Yes, it is, John.
It's Bob... Bob Edwards? Bob Edwards?
This is your big day, John.
Oh my, it's 3 a.m. I got
it's
the call.
3 a.m. on day one.
Day one? I guess the question is, am I ready on day one?
Yes.
We're ready. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Yep, we are indeed ready. Many thanks to Bob Edwards and welcome. It's Monday, April 28th. In the push for the Democratic presidential nomination, John, there's more talk about race. Today, the checks are in the mail to stimulate the economy. But gas prices might be getting higher. This morning, striking oil workers in Scotland and Nigeria have sent prices to new records. And in the NFL draft, big dollars equal big bets.
In other headlines at this hour, and it is 8 a.m. rather than 3 a.m., the U.S. military says American and Iraqi troops have killed 38 militants in fighting in Baghdad. That includes 22 killed in an attack on a checkpoint in a Shiite militia stronghold. The fighting has been described as some of the fiercest in Iraq in weeks. There's more violence in the Gaza Strip. A Palestinian woman and her four children are among seven dead. Officials and relatives say the woman and her children were getting ready to sit down to breakfast when an Israeli tank shell hit their home.
In China, a high-speed passenger train jumped its track and slammed into a regional train. At least 70 people are dead and more than 400 injured. Authorities say human error was to blame. That was a very quick conclusion. The BBC's James Reynolds is on the scene.
A train here in Beijing had been heading to Qingdao on the east coast. But before it got there, reports say that it derailed. Then a second train going in the opposite direction crashed into it.
That was the BBC's, I should have said, James Reynolds. Barack Obama's former pastor says his critics have it all wrong. Reverend Jeremiah Wright told the crowd he's not divisive when he talks about racial injustices. He says he's simply describing the, quote, conditions in this country.
The Federal Reserve meets tomorrow and Wednesday. It's expected to bump down a key interest rate again to brace the wobbly economy. That rate could turn out to be the last cut for a while. Zooming energy and food prices are raising concerns about inflation. And stocks in Europe opened higher for the fourth day in a row. The Nikkei rose a little less than a half a percent to hit a two-month closing high. And the Dow and S&P futures are both higher moderately in advance of the Wall Street Open.
Guess what, John?
It's a new show. It's called The Takeaway.
It's called The Takeaway, and we'll be live with you every morning.
Which means you're going to be live with us, part of a conversation. And in that conversation, we're asking you a question every morning. And this morning's question is
about your morning. We've made one change to your morning routine, of course, to ours, too. Just being here, we want to know, what else would you like to change about the morning?
And think big. You know, would you flip the sun and the moon? Or just think in terms of your menu for breakfast.
Like you could have fondue or
fondue.
Like Shrimp for breakfast. Shrimp and grits, they do that in New Orleans.
877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Here we are.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Well, anyone who thinks that race isn't a central issue in this presidential election campaign wasn't near a television yesterday. The day began with talk show pundits whose words of the day seemed to be, well, let's just see if you can guess.
White working class voters.
White voters in Pennsylvania.
About getting those white working class voters.
I mean, this problem with downscale voters exists.
You know, the white working class and the black middle class and whoever else we're slicing it today.
Regular people, real people.
This group, white working class voters, are a group the Democratic Party has had trouble with in general.
Well, there's no question that Barack Obama has a deficit when it comes to white working class voters.
White working class voters. And to get them, Democratic contender Barack Obama has to find a way to connect. And the Sunday pundies, of course, had some suggestions.
They want to hear him talk about meat and potatoes issues.
Bread and butter, kitchen table, economic issues.
He's not a GQ cover. He really does like pot roast and Jell-O. And
things like gas prices.
The son of a single mother, and he was paying off his law school loans until recently.
That he patches up his suits, that he used to eat Jell-O mold, and people do know him.
She's repainted him as Bambi.
A part of the elite.
He's not a happy candidate.
Why can't you just leave me alone to eat my waffles?
Characterizations of white culture, Jell-O, Bambi, and waffles. Then the day ended with the pastor of the moment speaking live at an NAACP meeting in Detroit.
I am not running for the Oval Office. I've been running for Jesus a long, long time, and I'm not tired yet.
The Reverend Jeremiah Wright was introduced as the hottest brother in America right now, other than Barack Obama. The Wright speech was carried live by CNN and Fox News. It began with White yesterday and ended with Wright. Adora, I mean, this is without precedent. It seems to me this campaign is suddenly only about race. What do you think is going on?
Well, it is today. And obviously, it's always a snapshot, particularly with the cables that run in these 24-hour cycles. But race is a very complicated issue in this country, and there's clearly lots of reasons why there are tensions between blacks and whites, and this is hitting on one of them.
You know, I guess what's amazing to me is that this really isn't about race in the context of some policy, say Civil Rights Act, Voting Rights Act. There's no legislation at stake. It's a demographic issue. It's kind of mushy, and to that reason,
suspicious. It's not so mushy, though, because it really goes to what the real base emotional responses to issues, and those are the kinds of things that lead to policies. Mm.
Well, Jeff Zeleny joins us now from the New York Times. He's covering the Obama campaign and is on his way to North Carolina to catch up with the campaign. Jeff, thanks for joining us. How do you think the stickiness of race vis-a-vis the Wright comments yesterday affects the Obama campaign? And you certainly made some sort of suggestions of how it's affecting the campaign in your story this morning.
I think one of the things that the campaign would prefer to happen is for Reverend Wright just to go away and to not, you know, be giving speeches that are being aired on live television and whatnot. But that's clearly not going to happen. The campaign has, you know, has said it has no control over it, and this is a great example. It's obvious that they don't. But look, with the two primaries coming up in Indiana and North Carolina on May 6th, it is a worry for some in the campaign that this is still being discussed. Senator Obama had hoped to put this behind him in his race speech that he gave in Philadelphia, you know, now almost a month ago, but it is still an issue out there. But I'll tell you what, talking to voters who are registering as Democrats in record numbers in these places, they're not talking about it explicitly when you talk to them, but it certainly is an undercurrent in this campaign.
If this remains in the national headlines, Jeff, does this bear more on the November election than it does the primary contests coming up?
I think that's a great possibility. We heard Senator McCain yesterday talking about this really for the first time. He just happened to raise this issue on the same in the same news cycle that Reverend Wright was giving this speech in Detroit. He said he was shocked by this, and he thought his words were offensive. So I think this will definitely be an issue in the general election campaign should Senator Obama win the nomination.
Jeff, is it really realistic to suggest that perhaps one speech would put an end to an issue as convoluted and as intractable as racial relations in the United States of America?
Well, certainly it's not going to put an end to it. And the campaign, you know, was under no illusions that it would, but they thought it would at least sort of advance the ball and explain things to the chattering class, if you will. And I think it did for some extent. You know, we have no sense that Senator Obama's loss in Pennsylvania was really because of his association with the Reverend Wright. There were a series of things, you know, perhaps it was his less than, you know, outstanding performance in the debate a week before the primary. But, you know, certainly this is one of those things that feeds into people's questions about him. You know, who is this guy? And it's one of the things that the campaign is struggling to answer.
Well, Jeff Zeleny, we should point out that within the hour, Reverend Wright is scheduled to speak in Washington at the National Press Club, so it's unlikely that in this news cycle it's going to go away. And you are on your way to North Carolina to meet up with the campaign?
I am. Senator Obama will be campaigning in North Carolina for 2 days, today and tomorrow, and then it's back to Indiana. And that's really the central battleground here for the next week. It's viewed as, Senator Clinton certainly views it as a must-win, and it's a neighboring state to Illinois for Senator Obama, so he is trying to win there too. But Indiana's not that different from Ohio and some parts of Pennsylvania, so it's a very close race.
Jeff, thank you very much. Jeff Zeleny from the New York Times with the Obama campaign. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We have done well among every group because people are less interested in dividing the country along racial lines or regional lines. They're really focused on how are we going to solve these big problems.
But
right?
Money's going to help Americans offset the high prices we're seeing at the gas pump and the grocery store. And it will also give our economy a boost to help us pull out of this economic slowdown.
That first sound you heard was Barack Obama.
Followed by President Bush talking about the plan that's going to put $600 in the bank accounts of many taxpayers starting today. $150 billion stimulus package. Now, if you were to open your mail and find a stimulus package in it, what would you think would be in there? Something like maybe like a little
I'm trying
toy
to figure out what that screechy noise.
A back scratcher or something. I took this off my son's bike this morning. But in the economic euphemisms of this era.
That's another segment, John.
Yes, economic stimulus package replaces the old Depression era programs where the government puts money into big projects like public works and broad subsidies. It's totally different this time around.
Yeah, absolutely, because this time the stimulus is going straight to businesses and families. We're talking about the American consumer. The question is, can it work? Harriet Brackey has some theories on this. She's a personal finance columnist for the South Florida Sun-Sentinel. Hi there, Harriet. And tell us, is this a stimulus or is it just something to stop the collapse of retail spending?
Well, it's meant to get consumers out there spending at the mall, going to restaurants, doing something to get the economy back on the path to growth.
And is that what consumers are going to do? You watch very closely how people spend their money. Will they do that?
Well, you know, consumers are saying, a lot of them are saying they're going to save it. But the last time we got a check like this, when 2001, when they sent everybody a rebate, about 40% of the money got saved. The rest of it was spent. So.
No, well, you're right, because the University of Michigan says only 3 in 10 people said they actually plan to spend it, so many saying that they plan to save it. Goldman Sachs has identified the top 5 stocks that will probably benefit from the stimulus.
And stimulus stocks.
Stimulus stocks. And they have Cheesecake Factory, Best Buy, Darden Restaurants, Home Depot, JCPenney, Kroger, Kohl's, Royal Caribbean, Safeway, and Walmart. Do you think folks are going to go buy stocks at the time when you have high food prices and you have high gas prices?
No, I don't think they're going to do that. I think they're going to buy a treat, maybe a flat-screen TV, and that'll help Best Buy's
that
bottom line.
That helps Best Buy, yeah. But Cheesecake Factory was actually down in after hours over the weekend. I don't know if people are going along with that.
I think we should add, though, we're talking about people getting anywhere between $300 and $600 for folks earning less than $75,000. President Bush says during the first week alone, nearly 7.7 million Americans will receive their tax rebates, and that will come, of course, we're in a new age, electronically. So for some people, Harriet, they will get up to $1,800, and that includes a rebate of $300 per child.
Right. I mean, for some families, it can be a pretty good check. Now, I'm not sure that spending it is the best thing for their financial health. I mean, personally, I think paying off credit card debt is the best thing you could do.
And in fact, saving it isn't all bad for the economy, and we'll find out. We're actually asking people what they're going to do with their checks. We're also asking people how they would change the morning. Harriet, how would you change your morning?
How would I change my morning if I got a stimulus check?
No, forget the stimulus check. What would you do? What would you do to change the morning? What would make your morning different?
I would, if I had an extra half an hour, I would walk an extra 2 miles.
More
so you would make
time,
another half an hour for, you would create another half an hour for your mornings.
That's right.
But you know what? Someone's going to think, well, why don't you just get up a little earlier, Harriet?
Maybe that's what she's suggesting.
I came up pretty early with you this morning.
That's right. Harriet Brackey, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you from the South Florida Sun Sentinel.
Okay.
Send your suggestions about the morning or your stimulus check, too.
Or you can put them together. Like
my
Harry,
take at thetakeaway.org.
Doing,
that's
yeah.
right. 877-8-MY-TAKE. We'll have more of your responses later.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
We have some other headlines this morning, and for that, we have Femi Okeh, who's just joined us. What do you have?
Good to see you. In our top stories today, the price of crude oil creeps back to $120 a barrel. And around the nation, Continental Airlines says it's not going to pursue a merger with United Airlines right away. The surprise announcement comes after speculation that this merger could create the world's biggest airline. Reno, Nevada is getting over dozens of earth tremors. The weekend quakes are the latest in a series of tremors that have shaken the region over the last 3 months. Federal investigators say Iraq reconstruction contracts were never finished because of problems like excessive delays and poor performance that has cost taxpayers millions of dollars.
We're fired up! Won't take it no more! We're fired up! Won't take it no more! We're fired up!
There were protests in New York this weekend, and the protesters promised to continue following the outcome of the Sean Bell trial. Bell was shot by police detectives in 2006 on his wedding day. Three of those detectives were acquitted on Friday. And finally, a cautionary story from Modesto, California. Police are blaming a scratching cat for an accident that toppled a power pole and shut down a street for nearly an hour. A police sergeant said that a woman was driving with a cat in her lap, and the cat scratched the woman, and she promptly drove into a pole.
Wow, we're just one cat in the lap away from a giant blackout in America. You know, the Sean Bell story, seriously, yes. could get the federal government involved because John Conyers is meeting with the family today.
You're talking about Representative John Conyers
from Michigan. If the Sean Bell case goes into the federal courts, that case is going to be around for a long, long time. There's already civil action already pending.
By the family, by Sean Bell's fiancé and his family.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
It's 19 minutes past the hour.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project.
Asking, what is responsibility in this day and age?
Everybody has their own opinion.
Thoughts shared at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, New York Times Radio, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. The stimulus checks are going out to hundreds of thousands of Americans today. We're watching that. We're watching what's happening in Zimbabwe. We're also introducing ourselves, right, John? Because we are new. We are new on the cop. We are the new kids on the block.
And the radio is just the beginning of what we are. We're online. We are a conversation that you can be a part of. And we've already had some responses to our takeaway suggestion of what to do with the stimulus package. I'm going to buy an iPod and put the rest toward my travel fund, says SRD this morning.
Not bad. And James says, my stimulus will go to a boat for my friends as the flood water rises. Things are heating up everywhere. Also today, though, we are following what's happening with oil prices. There are some striking workers in Scotland. They have shut down a pipeline that carries nearly half of Britain's oil, causing the beginnings of consumer panic.
While the outbreaks of panic buying are sporadic, some drivers are finding difficulties getting fuel.
Just need diesel anywhere. This is the fourth garage I've been in. There's need diesel. Can't get any.
In Nigeria, also a major U.S. oil provider, workers are striking too, adding to tensions after pipelines there were attacked. And you add into the mix a skirmish on Friday between U.S. ships and Iranian ships in the Gulf. That sent oil prices up. A confluence of events that Lisa Marganelli, author of Oil on the Brain, Adventures from Pump to Pipeline, says could make the volatile oil markets even more vulnerable. Oil prices hit a historic peak close to $120 today across the globe. Lisa, do you anticipate further sharp increases?
Well, nobody knows. That's the thing, is all this, we're just kind of feeling around this market like, with a stick in the dark, basically. But this is so huge, you just never know. This could be kind of the day that we all remember. Oil prices have been rising for months, years now.
But incrementally, really. I mean, it's been a slow increase until the last couple of months, right?
Right. And it's sort of been like, you know, the story about the frog in the pot where the heat rises slowly and all of a sudden the frog goes, woo, I'm getting cooked. But what might happen today is that the price rises really dramatically and, you know, the frog could conceivably jump out of the pot and say, wow, we've really got to change our behavior. So there.
But before we even get to that, though, Lisa, really, are we talking about a supply issue? And what are the present and future markets? I mean, what are they worrying about most at this exact moment?
Well, today is a supply issue. Today is perhaps 2 million barrels, out of the market. There's 700,000 barrels, in Great Britain. And then maybe 1.5 in Nigeria are gone, and that's out of the total oil market of somewhere in 90 million barrels. So that's actually big. I mean, we have big price spikes on maybe 200,000 barrels being missing. This is 2 million.
Well, and Lisa, what's a 200,000 barrel event? What is a little event that suddenly we have to take really serious notice of in this crazy environment? And how do speculators, the new traders that are in the market, the pensioners who are actually trading in oil, how do they increase the volatility here?
Well, we don't really know that. What we know, though, is that over the past couple of weeks, we've had little things that have really sent the price up. We know that there's lots of people who are in the market. They're buying. They say oil is the new gold. They're buying oil because the U.S. currency is going down. So they put their money in oil. And then the question is kind of what do they do when they have their money in oil? And then we have little disruptions, even things like electrical plants going down around the world, which cause people to buy more diesel, or electrical plants that go down and cause a refinery to go down, and suddenly the whole world is affected. So we've had all these little kind of blips. A tanker was attacked, a Japanese tanker was attacked off of Yemen a week ago, and that caused kind of a little blip. But there's just these kind of little tiny moves. And, you know, almost every couple of days there's something happens in Nigeria that's 200,000 barrels. But
so in comparison, you would say the strikes now in Nigeria and the strikes in Scotland, that's a bigger event?
That's a big event. Plus, apparently, there's also attacks on the pipelines in Nigeria that are pretty substantial. And these are big. We don't know what's going to happen with this.
You know, at Harvard this week, a bunch of big economic geniuses like Robert Rubin, and, you know, he's a genius. I'm not, you know, disputing that. But they're all wargaming the issue of massive disruptions in oil delivery to the industrialized world. It's not something they've never done before, but it's a different world than the last time they tried this a couple of years ago, I would think, right?
Yeah, it is a different world. I mean, the oil price is probably double what it was the last time they played this game. But, you know, whenever those guys play the game, they always find out that we're overwhelmed and the government doesn't exactly know what to do because we don't know how to use the Strategic Petroleum Reserve and things like that.
So they play the game, we lose.
Yeah.
I see. Thanks, Lisa. That's terrific. You had a question.
Just very quickly, Iran, the rhetoric has been accelerating, and that is a country that provides 30% of oil. There was a skirmish on Friday between U.S. Ships and Iranian ships. Any fears of what happened 20 years ago when the U.S. blew up two Iranian oil platforms? Any fears of that happening again?
Well, you just always wonder when things are escalating there in the Gulf. 20 years ago, the U.S. did attack two oil platforms. It was supposed to be a little limited engagement to teach Iran a lesson, and it blew up to a one-day battle that turned into the largest naval battle since World War II, which is just kind of mind-blowing. It destroyed part of the Iranian Navy, and we're still in the Gulf 20 years later.
Of Oil on the Brain, Adventures from Pump to Pipeline. Thank you very much for joining us. And now it's time for the latest headline from Femi Oke. Hey there, Femi.
Hello there. In your main stories today, Barack Obama's pasta continues to make waves after speaking at the NAACP, and the Chinese government has sacked two rail officials after trains crash, killing 70 people on Monday and injuring hundreds more. Also in international news, UN officials meet in Switzerland today to tackle the global food crisis. They hope to prevent worsening food shortages and steep jumps in prices.
Haiti has a new prime minister. Henri Pierre was chosen to replace predecessor Rene Préval. He was replaced after rocketing food and fuel prices set off recent violent demonstrations, making the news in all the European newspapers today. A 73-year-old man in Austria has confessed to imprisoning his daughter for 24 years in a windowless cell with a soundproof door and fathering 7 children with her.
That's just too freaky, that story.
It's very unusual, but I promise you it is making all the news across Europe. So I'm bringing you all of the international stories. And one good story to end with. Doctors believe that they have found the secret to increasing vision in patients who are almost blind. They're using gene therapy and they're saying it's working beautifully.
That's so.
So the exciting finding is that the technology can work even in late stages of the condition.
Sorry, Adora, that was Professor Robin Alley just butting in there
for
you.
I didn't know the professor was coming, but that is so exciting. That is so exciting
for gene
therapy.
For a particular form of blindness.
But it's a start.
Yep.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project.
A catalyst for examining the decisions that confront people
trying to do the right thing.
Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. I want to remind you there's an enormous amount going on our website right now at thetakeaway.org. You can actually watch results of an oil war game simulation at Harvard tonight at 6 p.m. Eastern. And you can read a blog post from our guest, Lisa Marganoli, who was talking about the oil markets on the Takeaway website. And she's talking about the Fortis pipeline in Scotland and how important that is to recent spikes in the market. But we move now to Zimbabwe. And this weekend, Jindiah Fraser, the top U.S. diplomat for Africa, made some very blunt comments about Zimbabwe's drawn-out election process.
The region needs to speak very, very loudly and very clearly to President Mugabe and his government to say that the violence must come to an end immediately. It's unacceptable to beat people just because they've decided to go out and vote, and apparently to vote for change.
Zimbabwe's election was held March 29th, and the full results have yet to be announced. Ambassador Boniface Chijikteku, who is Zimbabwe's UN ambassador, we thank you for joining us this morning, Mr. Ambassador. What do you have to say about the reports of violence by ZANU-PF forces and government forces raiding opposition offices over the weekend? It's been widely reported, and there we have a U.S. diplomat talking about it.
Well, the issue of violence, I think the Zimbabwean government does not condone any violence in whatever form. But these are allegations from MDC that ZANU-PF is involved in violence. And we have seen one-sided report of this situation.
When you say one-sided, what do you mean? And have you indicated that there have been arrests of ZANU-PF individuals who have been defying government calls for restraint, as you mentioned a moment ago?
No, there is due process in Zimbabwe. If there's any violence that has been perpetrated in Zimbabwe, the police are there to see that there's law and order.
How many ZANU-PF were arrested?
If they haven't committed any crime, why should they be arrested?
So you don't believe they've committed any crime?
If somebody has been beaten and he has a complaint, he goes to the police, sure, the police will take action.
Mm-hmm. Why don't we know the results of the election? It was March 29th. I mean, Zimbabwe is a large country, but it's not that large. It does seem to be an excessive amount of time.
According to who?
Well, I think, you know, even in the United States, we had some difficulties back in 2000, but the result was eventually known. It doesn't appear as though we're ever going to get to the bottom of this. What is the holdup?
In Florida, it was 6 weeks.
All right. So we'll know in 6 weeks.
Maybe before that.
All right. But what is the holdup? I mean, the holdup in Florida, I can go on for hours about what the holdup was in Florida. What is the holdup in Zimbabwe?
According to the Electoral Act in Zimbabwe, if there's any discrepancy in the vote, the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission is supposed to investigate that before they announce the result.
Mm-hmm.
That's in the presidential. In the case of parliamentary elections, so if there's any discrepancy, the complainant is supposed to submit his complaint within 48 hours, and then there will be an investigation. This has been done, and we have done a recounting. And before, when the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission said they wanted to do a recount, the whole international community, even including Jendai Fraser, accused the government that they are going to steal away the elections. But that recount has reconfirmed the wins of the opposition. So you see.
So do you believe that the opposition has won?
Won in terms of what?
The presidency, the parliamentary majority?
In terms of the parliamentary, yes. They've got 99 seats, and ZANU-PF has got 97.
Okay.
And there's a tendency that's been to combine the two opposition as one, but that's not the fact on the ground.
No, I'm aware there's a presidential election and the parliamentary elections. Are you saying it's impossible for the election result to be, as Morgan Tsvangirai, the opposition leader, has suggested, a total straight-out win for the opposition, thus taking Robert Mugabe from power, the president?
When you look into the situation in Zimbabwe, ZANU-PF or President Mugabe, they've never claimed that they won the election, and contrary to what people have been saying. What independent indicators say, none of the candidates got a 50-plus-1 vote. In our constitution, if you don't get 50% plus one vote, then you've got to go for a runoff.
That I understand. I guess what is so curious is that ZANU-PF and Mugabe aren't declaring victory. It does appear as though this is a deliberate attempt to hold up the elections. I mean, you would think in a situation like this, when a candidate feels as though maybe they've won, that they would declare victory or suggest, we've won, don't worry, when we get to the bottom of this, we will be the winners. But Mugabe isn't saying that. ZANU-PF isn't saying that. It looks like things are being prolonged for political reasons.
When you look at it, from the MDC point of view, they've been claiming victory over it. They would say they would wait for the official results. They claim victory. They push out all sorts of allegations. They go international. The Zimbabwe Electoral Commission is going through the due process. And they've been, when they were counting the votes, they realized there were anomalies, which they have looked into. And they cannot announce the results before they rectify the anomalies.
Mr. Ambassador, with all due respect, it's not just the MDC who are making claims of violence, of their members being or their supporters being attacked. You have the Zimbabwe Association of Doctors for Human Rights. You have Human Rights Watch reports. And you have members of the UN who are concerned beyond the UN representative from the United States. Why do you think all of these groups would say that attacks were being made upon the supporters of the opposition if none of it is true?
We see an agenda, a common agenda here. We had Gordon Brown and we had the U.S. in the UN Security Council. When we were discussing a different subject, they came up with the issue of Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe has been under siege for a long time. The United States and the UK have been going for a regime change in Zimbabwe.
Why do you think that is?
We took land from the white settlers in Zimbabwe in 2000.
So it's a racial issue, you think?
Yes, it is.
All right, well then why has Angola decided to stop a boat in harbor with weapons for Zimbabwe, and the Angolan government is saying that the boat bound for Zimbabwe with weapons is being held in Angola because they believe those weapons are going to be used for intersectarian strife and more violence?
I can't speak on behalf of Angola. I don't know their reasons. But those weapons were ordered a year ago, and they've just been coming to Zimbabwe. They have no relevance to what is happening in Zimbabwe at the present moment.
And why would Angola take this step? Because they are your ally.
I'm hearing from you what I know, that the ship could not dock in South Africa. It went to Angola. And the international media said the ship had gone back to China.
Well, Mr. Ambassador, we certainly appreciate you coming in here for some tough questioning this morning. Certainly the international community is very focused on what is going on with the Electoral Commission in Zimbabwe. We hope to know the result, perhaps not within 48 hours, but you did seem to suggest a six-week. We'll know about the same time the U.S. knew about Florida.
Well, I can assure you that I think within the next day or so, we should be able to get the results out.
We will talk to you about that. Boniface Chijiteki is Zimbabwe's UN ambassador. Thank you very much for joining
us. My pleasure.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I can't wait to get down there. I can't wait to meet the guys and really just start to get to work and get this whole thing started, because the draft process is a long time from the end of the season to today. And it's just going to be nice to get into a routine and go down there and start preparing for next year.
Yes, that's Mr. Ryan, the number 3 pick in the NFL draft, drafted by the Atlanta Falcons. The 2-day spectacle at Radio City Music Hall in New York City was a cross between watching a cattle auction and watching paint dry. But hey, the draft is the first hint of changes for teams this fall. Gary Belsky is the editor-in-chief of ESPN Magazine. Gary, thanks for joining us. This isn't just talent scouting anymore. It's become blunt economics.
I would have described it as watching cattle being painted.
Yes.
By the way, at
I would watch that.
Which at some points is actually kind of interesting.
I would watch that. Yes.
Okay.
Well, what do you make of the first three? What does that mean? Certainly, Michael Vick era is over if the Falcons are.
Well, the big issue in the NFL draft these days is that NFL teams have finally. Some teams have already realized this, but NFL teams have finally realized that the draft is structured such that it's broken. In that they have to commit so much money, especially to the early picks, that for fans, the greatest thing, which is, oh my God, my team has a lottery pick. Essentially, they might be able to find the one player who will send my team to the Super Bowl. It's not really the reality for teams. Instead, they are finding that when you guarantee a lot of money to these early picks, there's only a decent chance that they're actually going to pan out in any way that's going to be materially good for your team.
What's so fascinating, though, is when you take a look at some of the 6th, 7th, 8th round picks, some of the superstars are in there. Tom Brady was picked in the 6th round. He didn't get the big money in the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, for people who are deep inside the NFL draft, and it's a strange phenomenon, by the way, seeing all of these middle-aged men lusting after young boys. In almost any other context, it would be strange.
Family show. Family show.
In this context, Family it's show. Not strange at all. But the what's interesting about the NFL draft is there is a great deal of time spent on evaluating talent, and what we find is that in the long run, most of that time, it's about a 50-50 chance that your assessment of a given player will actually pan out. So, yeah, there are legendary stories about players drafted in later rounds who end up being the best players in that draft. You know, there used to be, by the way, there's only 7 rounds in the NFL draft. 35 or 40 years ago, there were something like 20 rounds. Johnny Unitas was famously picked in a double-digit round, right?
Wow.
He's arguably one of the 5 best quarterbacks in NFL history.
That is interesting. What's the Roethlisberger-Eli Manning sort of draft? I mean, that's sort of the classic case of somebody picked very close to the top, but Roethlisberger performed really well. Manning finally got to the Super Bowl last year.
Yeah,
deep in the draft, better?
Yeah, it's so funny. Manning was a number one pick, and Roethlisberger was also a first-round pick. Both of them actually panned out, right? If you asked almost any NFL general manager or coach, you're going to pick a quarterback in the first round, and within 4 years, he or she is going to win a Super Bowl for you, I think that would be considered a success. Generally, what you want to do if you're an NFL team and are trying to pay attention to your dollars and cents is be able to sort of get a lot of picks in the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th rounds. That's where you can sort of find your value. Increasingly, by the way, what's happening with the NFL draft is it's becoming much more like the stock market, in that there are kind of Warren Buffett types of folks who are looking to sort of find efficiencies.
Yes, well, we do sports. Gary Belsky, thanks for joining us, the editor-in-chief of ESPN, the magazine. And of course, you got to come to thetakeaway.org because we've got all kinds of things happening. We're not just a radio show or a website. You can give us your responses on how you would change the morning, all kinds of things at my take at the takeaway.org. Join us. Mix it up.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project.
Now featuring Mandy and Lester.
A short film about a girl who loses 2 boxes of Girl Scout cookies.
A boy who finds those cookies.
And who finds that returning them isn't going to be as simple as it seems.
Available at ResponsibilityProject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, New York Times Radio, and WGBH Radio Boston.
It's Monday, April 28th, and we have some headlines for you. And I know this because Femi Oke is sitting right in front of me. What do you got?
This morning, we're following the news of a train crash in China that's left 70 people dead and hundreds injured. We're also awaiting a press conference from Barack Obama's pastor. He's due to speak at the National Press Club in about the next 30 minutes or so. There will be no winning streak for Danica Patrick. We're on to sports news now. After last week's breakthrough Indy victory in Japan, Dana Weldon won the Road Runner Turbo Indy 300 at Kansas Speedway for the second straight year. Patrick, who last week became the first woman to win an Indy race, wound up on the sideline with a broken wheel hub. The Cleveland Cavaliers are one win away from advancing to the second round. Delatay West hit the go-ahead three-pointer with 5.4 seconds left.
In the corner, Delatay West, the three. He got it! Delatay West with a big shot, and the Cavaliers lead by three.
That was Delonte West, and that announcer was very excited. The Cleveland Cavaliers beat Washington 100-97 for the 3-1 lead in their best-of-seven Eastern Conference playoff series.
Can LeBron make it to the finals? That's really the question, LeBron.
And he
James,
plays right? for yeah. a Cleveland team.
Cleveland, yes. But he, good, good. Will you take NBA for 40?
Oh,
thank you.
Adora's cooking thank you. Today.
Thank you.
As she needs.
Thank you, Femi.
Hamatan Aziz.
What has become a more common occurrence? That's Afghan President Hamid Karzai on national television assuring his nation that he's still alive. He did so yesterday after the fourth assassination attempt since he took office nearly 6 years ago. The attackers, Taliban soldiers, claimed responsibility for shooting up an official military parade, which included the U.S. ambassador. When the bullets started flying, the distinguished crowd scattered. 8 people were wounded. 3 people were killed. Alistair Leithhead is the BBC correspondent in Kabul. Alistair, arrests have already been made. We'll get to that in a moment. But first, this was the first time the Taliban attacked Karzai in Kabul. Are they getting bolder?
Well, it's certainly a very brazen attack. This is a huge thing. It's the National Day. It celebrates a famous victory of Afghanistan, overthrowing finally the Soviet-backed government in 1992. A huge military parade, not only remembering that, but also looking forward by showing off the latest that the Afghan National Army has to offer. It's growing all the time because of the funding it's getting, and it's developing into an army of more than 50,000 soldiers now. President Karzai, just before the incident happened, was riding atop a Humvee, which had obviously been provided by the US. He was parading in front of a who's who from Afghanistan, power brokers sort of past and present. He then
there was a message in this attack. Do you think at this point Afghans are capable of being comforted? And what is the scene like in Kabul today? Is there increased security?
Well, there was a lot of security ahead of the celebration that was going on. But, of course, nevertheless, the Taliban gunmen were still able to fire shots in the direction of the crowds who were watching the procession from only 400 or 500 meters away. It's difficult to know whether it was really an actual attempt on his life, of President Karzai, because it's such a long distance away. But we saw from the television footage, because this was shown live on Afghan TV,
right,
that two members of parliament were struck just 30 or 40 meters away from where President Karzai was standing when the national anthem was being played and when the 21-gun salute was being fired.
Alistair Leithhead, BBC correspondent, reporting from Kabul. Many thanks.
You know, it's interesting. 40 years ago, Nixon used to say, "I'm not a crook." Karzai says, "I am not dead." I don't know. I actually thought your question was great. Can the Afghan people be reassured? But in a related story, and it's a twist in an already twisted notion of justice in the prison on Guantanamo Bay, today the mental competence of Osama bin Laden's driver, Salim Ahmed Hamdan, will be argued in a military court. Hamdan's lawyers say the conditions of his detention are responsible for making him insane. This is just the first of many potential blockbuster revelations from the so-called terrorist detention center. The former chief prosecutor for Guantanamo is scheduled to testify for the defense, arguing that the Pentagon asserted undue influence on the Guantanamo legal system and pressed for prosecutions for political reasons. Bill Glaberson is at Gitmo covering the hearings for the New York Times, living in a tent city with hundreds of journalists and lawyers. We'll get to that in a second. But Bill, again, Guantanamo, again, the U.S. Constitution seems to be in the balance. Does the Hamdan case slice the constitutional issues any differently, do you think?
Oh, I think what we've learned about Guantanamo and the legal system in the United States is that there is an infinite number of challenges to the basic fundamental questions of how, you know, we view the Constitution and what we view as fundamental legal rights.
So I guess, you know, the Hamdan case, the competence to stand trial, just describe how that issue plays in this small case. And then what's the larger issue for other detainees, because these are all starting to come to trial now?
It's quite a fascinating issue. You know, for 6 years now, there's been international criticism of the way the U.S. holds people here on this military base in Cuba. The way it plays out in this particular case at this particular moment is that his lawyers say that Hamdan has been held in isolation for so long and essentially driven crazy by the conditions of his confinement that he's in such a condition that he can't work with them, that he can't participate with them, that the only thing that he can focus on is getting out of what they call solitary confinement, and therefore they say that that denies him the right to an attorney because he can't really effectively work with them and effectively denies him a fair trial. So that's one of the issues that will be put before a military judge today. Interestingly, as is often the case in Guantanamo, it's being put forth, this very provocative argument, by a military defense lawyer.
That is so interesting. Does the U.S. government have an argument that before, quote-unquote, we allegedly drove him insane, we got some great information out of him that has prevented any number of terrorist attacks here in the U.S., or is that under wraps?
I don't know the details of what information he might have supplied, but certainly that is always the argument in these cases, that when they got these people and they got him in 2002, very early on in Afghanistan, that they were interrogating him for, you know, intelligence, military intelligence. He was, after all, somebody who had been close to Osama bin Laden and had, they say, helped bin Laden elude capture right after the 2001 attacks. So they say, you know, you can't apply typical legal standards the way you would to a police officer in New York City, for example, because these were military interrogators interrogating him under war conditions, literal war conditions at that time. Of course, Hamdan, like many of the detainees here at Guantanamo, has been interrogated hundreds and hundreds of times. And we are led to believe many of these people are still being interrogated 6 years later. So one of the arguments that the lawyers make is 6 years later, you're not talking about wartime conditions. These
Right.
people are being held here very similar to an American prison.
So what do you make of the chief prosecutor for Guantanamo testifying on potential political allegations of the Pentagon intervening in the justice process? I mean, it seems as though a lot of people are running for cover here, even in the Pentagon establishment, on this whole Gitmo procedure.
Well, you know, it's 6 years of Guantanamo, and Guantanamo has turned almost everything on its head, and this is one of those incredibly weird twists in the Guantanamo story, that you have the man who was essentially the Pentagon spokesman for Guantanamo.
I mean, he's a former now, but he's former now. But
yes,
go ahead, yeah.
Former, he resigned or left office, depends who you listen to, in October. And actually, this morning, if he takes the stand, he's likely to be cross-examined by his successor, another military colonel who
amazing.
Is now the chief prosecutor.
Well, Bill, we have to move on. You're a pretty good camper down there, I read from your article. You're living in a tent city and 550 court officials and journalists and reporters all in the same tent city.
Yes, I don't know about good. I think if you ask the soldiers here, they would say that I'm kind of a complainer.
William Glaberson of the New York Times. It takes a good complainer to get to the truth, we think.
You think so?
Oh, I think definitely. There must be so miserable down there, Gitmo. But we don't need to focus on that.
No, we don't.
No, this is, you know, I have to say, my morning was changed this morning, and I'm delighted to spend it with you, Adora.
Absolutely.
I don't think I would change a thing
and
from
back
here.
To you, John
yeah.
Hockenberry.
This is a different kind of radio show. We have all kinds of ways you can get to us to join our conversation, hang out with us. We've made one change to your morning with our program today. What else would you change about the mornings? Email is at mytake@thetakeaway.org. We've got some responses.
We do. Fanny says, I'm calling from the New York State Freeway on the Garden State Parkway. I would love to change the length and type of my commute. It's always congested and always frustrating. Thanks for asking, she adds.
Thanks for asking. A cry for help there from Fanny. On Spinbox, which records your voicemails and turns them into text for us, which is a great feature. And there's lots of other things on our website. You'll find video of Mrs. Kunkel's fifth grade class lobbying for their favorite candidates from Pennsylvania. It's golden stuff.
And you may be able, you may be one of the millions of taxpayers about to get a bump in your bank account. We're also asking, what would you do with the money? Tell us, mytake@thetakeaway.org, or call our Spinbox line at 1-877-8-MYTAKE.
I'm kind of your stimulus package, Adora, just personally.
I don't even understand that, John. We started the show with that. We're ending the show. I don't know what is going on, folks.
Just email us at thetakeaway.org.
And we read every comment.
877-8-MYTAKE.
We read them.
We do.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Freeman Foundation, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.